Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the first weekend of July 2020. It's been a relatively sunny start to the month here, a contrast with June, which was very gray here in Sitka. I think only a handful of days had more than just a few sun breaks, and I don't think any of those even had a full day of clear skies here. So it was relatively cool and gray, cloudy, with sometimes quite heavy overcast on those later June days when we were getting a fair amount of rain. So with the forecast on the 1st of July showing sunny skies throughout the end of the week, it was something to look forward to. And as it turned out, the marine layer held on just a little bit longer and the skies didn't clear until around midday on the 1st. But after that, it was sunny and clear. And the next day, Thursday, was record-setting heat here in Sitka with a high temperature officially at 83 degrees. It was quite interesting to be out in that much heat. We don't really get that much warmth here to get over the 80s. It's often years between days when we hit 80 degrees. So it's kind of novel experience, a little warmer than I prefer, as I'm one who definitely appreciates the mild climate that we have here in Southeast Alaska. But I did get out and enjoy the sunshine during these days, and hopefully you did as well. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. If you are getting out, please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. It was great to hear from a listener this past week who had noticed noctilucent clouds on Thursday night. I had seen those as well before I was going to bed in the north. There's these silvery blue shining clouds at night, and sometimes you're not quite sure what's going on there, but kind of a very distinctive look once you know what to look for. Unfortunately, it's been so cloudy this year, we haven't had a chance to look for those, so I'm hoping that we'll have some clearer skies going forward throughout the rest of the year and have a chance to see those. But the conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded with Hannah Blanke. She's an avian care specialist at the Alaska Raptor Center here in Sitka. We recorded this conversation at Totem Park, so you may hear a little bit of background noise from planes or boats that were passing by while we were talking. We'll go ahead and join the conversation with her sharing a little bit about her experience before she joined the Raptor Center in 2017.
I finished college in 2012 where I studied wildlife ecology. And then after that, I did 5 years of like internships, fellowships, short-term employment, whatever you can get, doing environmental education as well as wildlife rehab. So most environmental education centers will have birds of prey as education birds. And then with the wildlife rehab, I was seeing all kinds of birds. And I sometimes go in the woods and look at birds.
Yeah.
Not as much as my bosses do, but I like to see a good bird now and again.
Well, it is. Yeah, it is interesting. I suppose that kind of mix of stuff is like pretty much exactly what you're doing. I know the Raptor Center has a lot of, this year maybe being an exception, but most summers, you know, there's a lot of tourists coming through and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of displayed bird education, but also a lot of rehab, you know, primarily the raptors. But it's my understanding that you'll take any native species that basically is injured and seems rehabable.
Yeah, so any non-invasive native species. So that excludes starlings, house sparrows. I haven't seen any here, but if they ever show up.
Yeah.
And then rock pigeons as well. Since those are all invasive animals, we can't treat them with our permits.
Oh, and collared doves probably?
You know, we've never gotten one, but that would also fall under there. And then we also like to say wild because sometimes people bring us their chickens and turkeys.
Oh, wow.
And it's like, we can't we can't afford to be a poultry vet, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. So I know, I'm sure that seasonally the things that show up probably... it varies quite a bit this time of year. I've been noticing a lot of fledglings around, and I guess it's still a little early. Probably the eagles are still very much in the nest. But it seems like in some years you even get nestlings from raptors and so forth that I guess fall out of the nest and can't be put back.
Or... Yeah, we've actually got an eaglet at the center right now from Juneau. We think it was taken out of the nest because it is so young. And it was found, like, under a log, and they couldn't locate an eagle nest anywhere nearby. So they think it was kind of somehow carried away from the nest and then crawled under a log.
Okay, so, like, I guess the eagle nest, I mean, the young are pretty vulnerable, and the parents are out getting food, so that the eaglets could be somewhat vulnerable in that way. I don't know, do eagles go after other eagle nests sometimes?
It's rare, but it can sometimes happen. Yeah. There's also always the possibility that the baby was kicked out of the nest. we can't find anything physically wrong with it, but sometimes if birds have something wrong with them, the parents will figure, you know, why waste resources on something that's not healthy and right. just kind of chuck it out.
Yeah, yeah, I guess that makes sense. I mean, it's kind of a tough, it's a tough go. You got to get a lot of food, and growing birds, they grow a lot in a season. So, like, for an eagle, I'm not quite sure how big the eggs are. I'm assuming they're
about goose egg size.
Goose egg size. All right. Yeah, I was thinking it probably bigger than a chicken, but
I think like 3 ounces, I want to say.
And so they're in eggs for, do you know how long they're in the eggs for?
Yeah, they're in their eggs for about a month.
A month. So for quite a while. And so mm-hmm. and then when they hatch, they're very small, and mm-hmm. within a season they grow to essentially adult size.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems like it's a lot of food. I mean, what is it? Two years ago now? Maybe it was three. There was a golden eagle nest
out at
Blue Lake. Yeah, and just thinking about how much food, I think there was definitely two young birds in there for a while. I don't know if, I think maybe only one fledged, and one person who was watching it that really liked raptors was pointing out, well, the second one sometimes is essentially a larder. It's easier to keep up. And then when it gets to a certain point, it gets eaten by the sibling, which I guess, you know, from a certain standpoint makes some sense for survival in general, but it's a little grim by kind of our
it can be sometimes hard with people that don't know just as much about birds,
mm-hmm.
who want all birds to be, you know, cuddly and loving and caring as much as a human would care for their child, but it's hard feeding a baby, and if you've got one baby that's slightly less healthy, you want to put all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah, maximize the chance of the one. I mean, we as humans live in essentially abundance right now. Like, mm-hmm. we have very little lack for food or shelter or anything. It's not the same. Those golden eagles were, I mean, I guess they eat most anything that they can catch, but they were regularly gone for a long time. They could have been going tens and tens of miles at least to find food. You know, I don't know what they were catching.
I think a lot of pine martens is what we were told.
Oh, for here?
Or maybe some kind of martin?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I mean, because like, there's no reason that they would have to stay on Baranoff Island. They happen to be nesting on Baranoff Island. And it occurred to me, like, I think on the mainland they're known for eating marmots.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have marmots on here. And it occurred to me they could fly the 100 miles. You know, I don't know how fast they fly, but they could fly pretty far to get food. I've heard they also go after young goats sometimes.
Yeah.
And so then there would be young goats on Baranoff that I assume, you know, the one guy I was talking to when he did some research into it, he's like, oh, it turns out that golden eagles eat just about anything that birds eat, you know, and they're just, and when they're feeding, I think they're just going out, and they'll steal food from other birds or whatever, but they were gone. The adults were gone for extended periods of time. I'm assuming just, you know, scouring the ridge lines and so forth. And we do have martens on Baranoff. It's just interesting to think, because they're usually in the forest. Although I have seen their droppings up high, so they could be out in the, kind of on the ridges and stuff, going after voles up high. I don't know if the golden eagles go after voles. They're pretty small.
I think that might push it, just in terms of, like,
trade-offs.
What are you getting out of it?
Right, the energy output to get what you get out of that. But yeah, it was kind of fun to watch those from the nest. And of course, there's many bald eagle nests around here. I'm assuming, although I don't know, I'm assuming though from the abundance of bald eagle nests that it's much easier for them to find the food by fishing and doing the things that they do.
Yeah,
Than it is for golden eagles, which in that case was the first and still only documented nest away from the mainland in Southeast Alaska for those birds.
Mm-hmm.
So. And yeah, nobody was really expecting to see them out here. But so these young eaglets, like, what's the presumably, you know, it's you do your best to try and raise them if there's nothing like that seems seriously wrong with them. But what's the prognosis? Like, how successful, how easy is it to raise one from pretty small size?
If they've got like their downy coat,
mm-hmm.
then the chances of them surviving increases a lot. But it still is really difficult to raise them appropriately. Just in terms of making sure they don't get habituated to people is one of our big concerns. So we'll have to like use a puppet or cover our faces, or once they're a little older, we actually put them in a nest in our flight training center so they see eagles all the time. But the one we have currently, for example, came in, was super hungry, we fed it up, and then it wasn't able to process that food, and it actually got sauerkraut, which is, they store their food in like a little pouch on their neck called a crop. And if they don't pass the food down to their stomach fast enough, the food can start kind of rotting in their crop. So it's easy to identify because it smells horrible.
Right. Yeah, bad breath.
Yeah, the worst. So he had become very dehydrated. And we're not sure if he got too hot or what else happened. So it's those things where it's like one day they're fine and eating and the next day
they're not so fine.
Some that we got in last year, we think they had some issues with calcium deficiencies because we'll give them supplements. We give them like calcium and VitaHawk, which is just a nutrient supplement. But some of the eaglets, once they got big enough to start standing up, they actually were getting little like micro fractures on their bones. And so we're not sure if that was a genetic thing or what exactly happened. It's tricky, too, because in the wild, it's not like a lot of the babies survive.
Right.
But we always assume, like, once they're under human care, they must be able to survive better because we can provide food and safety.
Yeah.
But it's just hard being a baby.
Right. Yeah. Well, I suppose they probably do survive better, but it still is.
But it's not a walk in the park.
Right. Well, and it is interesting. I imagine it took folks a while, and it's still a field in development, I suppose, for how best to do the rehabbing, and I guess there's even questions of when is it worth bringing in a bird and investing in trying to rehab it. And like in the case of California condors, that was an immense investment in, but they were down to what, 7 birds or something, and something very small. Now they've been releasing, and it sounds like they're actually nesting in the wild again. So, so that investment was to save the species. But if you have an abundant bird, it's like, okay, well, what are the chances? What are the trade-offs for bringing it in? But so I imagine there's people all over. Well, it's not even just birds at that point. It's wildlife rehab in general. But is there like a community of people worldwide essentially that are kind of working on this and looking at these questions and developing best practices and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's a worldwide organization, but I know there's a North American one. There's, everything there'd be for any other scientific group. There's conferences, there's books people put together, there's forums where you can go online and ask questions, and people that have more experience can help kind of guide you in what direction you need. It can be hard to do proper scientific studies. Just because, if you're trying to test the efficiency of a drug, sometimes you might have to, to see if the drug was efficient. If you want to, really see into the animal, you kind of got to kill it to be able to actually dissect it. Wildlife rehab tends to not want to do that.
Right.
So a lot of times people will go off of studies that have been done on similar domestic animals. So, pet birds or poultry.
I suppose, and there's a lot of people that do falconry, so for the raptors, I suppose.
Yeah, so we can get a better idea with raptors on just raising, raising them, just because falconry has such an old history of people raising birds from such a young age.
They're less concerned about the people associations, I suppose, but... So in the case of like an eagle, the problem with it becoming habituated to people is that it hangs around in town too much and basically is vulnerable to the things that cause problems when wildlife hangs around in town too much.
Yeah. So we want, whenever we get babies in, we want to raise them as wild as possible. If they get too comfortable around people, they might start seeing people as a source of food. Like, not eating people, but hanging around boats. Because, there's fish and there's a human. The human will give me that fish.
Right.
And then, as you said, just staying in town, most of the adult eagles that come in are injured in some way because of humans. Not intentionally, for the most part, but hitting electrical lines, hitting windows, getting hit by cars, being poisoned. So as much as we love seeing them, we would love to see them not in town,
right?
Where they expose themselves to more dangers.
Well, it is I mean, this time of year, especially with the fishing season and so forth, but they come in the park here. I've seen them just like, they are not very aware. Like, they're just all in on this scrum, going for this scrap of food. And then you find a piece of fish in the forest somewhere where they none of them got it in the end. But it seems like kind of, when they're flying through where there's electrical lines and cars, they're just all in on the food and not paying any attention really to the surroundings. Maybe that's not so.
Yeah, no, that's a lot of car accidents are because, well, a lot of times when birds are hit by cars, especially in the case of like eagles, bald eagles, they're scavenging on the side of the road for roadkill. They get spooked by something, they fly out, and then the car hits them because they're just not.
Is that happening fairly often? I mean, I know you all are drawing in birds from elsewhere in Southeast. I don't know if beyond that or not, but is that happening in Sitka very often? That I know every once in a while there's a story in the paper about the bird getting electrocuted on a power line or something, but seems like that doesn't happen too often. But are they getting injured pretty regularly here?
Not too much. I'd say actually power lines are probably the most common reason we get birds in. It's just when those birds come in, they're already dead. So we do still take them and we send them to. There's a big facility that you have to send all eagle bodies and feathers and parts to.
Right. So eagles are kind of a special case in that they have special protection as part of the. I guess it's because I don't know why. Because they're the national bird, but it seems like maybe it's more than just that. I don't know.
A small part of it also has to do with some native nations using eagle feathers.
Right.
So they have to have a way that they can get them legally.
And so, okay. So,
and so the repository will do that.
Yeah, the repository is. So you send all the eagle bit. So other birds, though, that would come in don't get treated in the same way, but it's the eagles get sent.
The eagles get sent to the repository. If we get interesting birds in that pass away, we'll send them to the. A museum in Fairbanks.
Yeah, the Museum of the North has a collection.
Yeah,
yeah. I've had birds go there.
Yeah,
the window kills and the whatnots that inevitably happen.
Uh-huh.
And then if you get known as somebody who's interested in birds, you get to collect other people's.
Yep, people bring us weird stuff, like stuff, just feet sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been a while, but 10 years ago or so, there was a really hard winter. And I think they had so many birds come into the Raptor Center. Some of them, many of them alive, but also many dead from starving.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of snow that winter, and it was a tough winter. One eagle has actually started killing other eagles and eating them.
Oh, wow.
It sounded like that was not usual, but that
not so
was
much.
Kind of a desperate winter. I can't remember how many eagles. Jen and Vicky were telling me it was just like a crazy number of eagles early in the year, you know, like more eagles than they'd get in a whole year they'd had in January or February or something like that. And I don't really remember, but it was a tough winter. And most of them were starving. So I imagine that for y'all, when you're getting eagles in, it probably tends to be the young birds this time of year and then the starving birds in the wintertime when they're not doing very well.
This time of year it's the younger ones. We also do unfortunately fairly regularly get in birds that have brood patches. So like their lower bellies have no feathers, which means they have either eggs or chicks in the nest. And if we get those and we try and turn them out as fast as we can because we want them to get back to their babies.
Are they usually injured or
usually what brings them in is that they've gotten some kind of injury, which is hard because we want to get rid of them.
Yeah.
Let's see. This year, though, I would say the cases that really stood out was we got about three or four juvenile bald eagles, so not out of the nest, maybe about 2 to 3 years old, from Juneau that we suspect they had gotten into an animal that had been euthanized.
Mm.
So they basically acted like they were drugged or in a coma. And those guys can be really easy to treat because you just got to give them time.
Right.
And
so it keeps them from getting got by something else, but
they
are able to process the stuff out of their system.
And hopefully they learn. Who knows?
Right. Well, and so when you get eagles from elsewhere, do you release them here or do they?
We will release them here.
Yeah.
Especially the young ones because they haven't established any kind of territory or anything yet. So they're free to go wherever they want.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't really think about eagles as being migratory so much because they're here all year, but clearly there is at least some migration because all the birds that show up in Haines for the fall early winter salmon run. And there used to be a bird here. And the other thing is that it's so not easy for me, at least, to recognize individuals. But
right.
But for a few years, I think at least 10 years, maybe it was only 8 years that we saw this bird that had white primaries.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
So it would fly. It kind of messed some people up because it didn't look normal. But the first time I actually saw it was, you know, we're sitting here near the beach at the park, was actually just down the beach a little bit, sitting in, and it was an immature bird at the time, but it looked weird. Like it had, but immature birds are kind of variable anyway. They're, mm-hmm. they're brown and mottled, and this had more of a white face, and I thought, well, maybe it's just transitioning. But then, I don't know, a few years later, this people started having pictures or just mentioning that they were seeing this adult with white primaries.
That's cool.
And it turned out that it also had some other lack of pigment, like its nails were white. And so it was interesting in that way. And then it took me a while, but I finally realized it was the same bird as I'd seen as an immature bird. And it was, so we could recognize that one. And on iNaturalist, a couple times, or at least once, I think somebody reported seeing it up in Haines once. And then I saw it in iNaturalist from Huna. Somebody had taken a picture.
Oh, nice.
Huna,
that's cool.
So it was relatively easy to recognize this individual and know that he had been traveling around Southeast Alaska a little bit. And I guess some actually go south. I was talking to somebody that, you know, was keeping track of things a bit at the airport, and he mentioned kind of, I don't know, is it February or March? Like it's often the case that a bunch of eagles start showing up around the airport. There's the resident pairs that are actually have their territories and will be, you know, territorial with each other, but then there's these other birds that come in and it's like they'd been somewhere else and they're just kind of moving back to their summering ground. So I don't know how much is known about eagle migration and territoriality and residence versus not, but is that something that you know anything about? Or
I mean, for the most part, when eagles move around, it tends to follow the food supply. Mm-hmm. So they'll kind of go steadily north in the summer as the salmon runs happen more and more. And then if they have a nest, they'll do their best to return to that same nest site. In fact, it's impossible to know what's going on in a bird's brain. They're a bird. I don't know. But it does seem as though the nest site is more important than who is there. Because there have been a lot of instances where an eagle will return to a nest, their mate isn't there, they just choose a new mate. Mm-hmm. Or their old mate gets driven off, and then they'll just mate with the new bird that arrived.
So they are mostly staying with the same mates, but it's not unusual to switch things up a little bit?
No, it's whoever is at the nest.
Oh, it's whoever's there.
They're both at the same nest site. Great.
Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah, it's just whoever is there, really.
Yeah.
And then there's always weird cases that pop up. Like last summer in either Iowa or Illinois, there was a nest that had two males and one female.
Oh.
And they coexisted and raised babies.
Well, I guess there's more folks getting the food then.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, and I guess, well, I mean, that's one of the success story. People still seem to be excited to see bald eagles here, but it seems to be less exciting than it used to be in some ways because so many parts of the U.S. are having bald eagles kind of reestablish.
Yeah.
And I remember walking through the park. And I often look like I might be a tourist because I have my binoculars or whatever in my backpack, my camera, and having people be like, oh, there's an eagle around the corner. It's like, all right, great.
Great.
Yes, there is, and I'm sure there's probably several others as well. It's easy for me to kind of take them for granted. So it's fun to see, you know, see a little bit through the eyes of others who are excited because they are an unusual bird, you know. And so many of that's one of the fun things about taking people out that aren't from here. It's like normal birds, that red-breasted sapsuckers or varied thrushes or things like that, they're cool, but, you know, I see them all the time, so I don't really think about it. I imagine them having all these exotic birds, but of course for them, those exotic birds are just the normal everyday birds for them, and we have the exotic birds here from their perspective. So with these young eagles, you mentioned that if they have their downy feathers already, that their survival rate is higher, but it's still... It's still a challenge, you know, keeping them fed and healthy. So, like, how much food are they needing to eat to grow in the way that, because they got to not only grow their body, but then grow in all those feathers, and that's a lot of feathers. Do they just get adult, I mean, they're not adult feathers, but flight feathers, You know, do those grow in right away? Is there a set of feathers that comes between the downy feathers and the flight feathers?
So you'll see like they're covered in like a fuzzy down. They look mm-hmm. kind of like Muppets. And then you'll start to see proper feathers poking through.
Mm-hmm.
And then those like covert, those covering feathers will come out. And then they'll like have their covert feathers fully covered before their flight feathers are fully out. But they all kind of grow in at once.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just get rid of their downy feathers and
then they're ready
call
to
it a day.
Ready to start to learn to fly.
Yeah, yeah. They look like they're ready to fly way before they're actually ready to fly, though.
I suppose they have a lot of work to develop the flight muscles.
Yeah, and just coordinate. They look mm-hmm. so awkward when they're young.
Well, that's one thing that always the marbled murrelets that nest in trees but can't do anything on land. Like they have to, their first flight has to get them to water or they don't mm-hmm. survive. And so it's incredible to me that, you know, they have such a low margin for error that they're able to build up the strength and coordination within the nest, essentially on the branch.
Yeah.
and then take off. And I guess enough of them survive
yeah.
that they do all right. But, it's maybe a little easier for eagles with, adults as examples and probably some encouragement to get a move on.
Yeah, and they can practice more. You'll see an eagle like on a young eagle on a windy day on a branch, like flapping its wings. It'll like raise off the branch a little bit and then land back down.
Just kind of getting a feel for that. Because yeah, I suppose the balance thing would be interesting as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get to be so acrobatic when they're, you know, when they actually, well, they're not so good in the forest, but chasing each other. But just out over the water, you know, the ways that they can pivot and turn and do things. So they definitely develop a high degree of skill in terms
yeah.
of moving around.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to just see how fast they can figure out how to fly. Like people always ask if we teach them how to fly, but no, it's all in, you know, it's
yeah.
humans know how to walk, birds know how to fly.
Right. Yeah. Their instinct is to do what they need to figure that out. So how much are they eating? Are you feeding them every day or?
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. We'll feed them. A couple of times a day in smaller amounts mm-hmm. so that they can pass everything through. I'm trying to think how much they get, though. I'd say maybe, like, 100 to 200 grams of fish when they're young with, like, the down feathers.
Mm-hmm.
But then just a week later, that might double in
right.
diet because they just grow so fast. We give full grown eagles, both juveniles and adults, we offer them 500 grams of fish a day.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is just because we don't want the birds in the flight training center to fight each other over
right.
food.
So that's more than they probably strictly would need, but
yeah. So they're definitely getting more than they would in the wild.
Mm-hmm. I guess that gives them a little bit of a cushion for when they do go out to figure out where food is. And
yeah. Yeah. There's, yeah, we also have the benefit of space, so we can be kinder to the younger ones mm-hmm. and let them have a little bit longer to figure things out.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, so that's like a pound of fish a day, or a pound of food a day, I guess. They're scavenging or whatever. Because I've wondered about that in the wintertime, for example. Like, are they eating every day? Or are they, because you see them sitting around in the trees and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I see them I've seen them eating gulls or ducks. But I've never seen them catch one. Obviously, they do sometimes. But whenever I've seen them chase, everything just flies away. And I've seen them actually give some pretty serious chase to birds, and the gulls in particular. And the gulls, if the gulls get a head start, they typically can outfly an eagle
yeah,
just because they're
yeah.
more maneuverable. But I think, well, man, that must take a bit of energy, and they gotta like figure out the trade-off between just sitting there and not using extra energy, but then also not getting any food. So.
Yeah, and once they're full grown, they can go without food for a couple of days.
Oh, okay.
They tend to, you know, like glut themselves
right.
and then rest and
hang out and let it all process. Yeah.
And that's also why in the winter we get starving birds that are typically juvenile bald eagles, mm-hmm. so less than 5 years old, is because they didn't figure out when is it worth it for me to hunt, mm. when is it not worth it. So they're chasing down all this prey, not catching it because they're young, wasting
right.
all their energy.
Yeah, then that makes sense. And I don't. Yeah, I guess it's just what I've seen here. I don't know how much fish they're catching, or they sometimes they I've seen him fighting with a raven over bread before, which then they pushed the raven off and then got to the bread and was like, oh.
Yeah. I don't think so.
Yeah, it was an immature eagle. No surprise.
Yeah.
But I haven't quite figured out what counts for food for them, I suppose. But so they're growing pretty fast, like in the period of when would they hatch typically in the wild? Like, are they by early summer they've hatched and are growing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think around April for here in town mm-hmm. is when they'll hatch out. And then it takes between 10 to 12 weeks for them to be fully grown and ready to fledge.
Mm, okay. 10 to 12 weeks. So that's like almost, it's 2.5-3 months almost.
Mm-hmm. So it's quick because, you know, you start with a little 3-ounce baby and then
you can fit in your hand.
You've got a 10-pound baby screaming at you for food still.
I'll bet they can be a little aggressive.
Oh, the juveniles are the ones that cause the most problems in our flight training center because they're the ones that will land next to an adult and scream and try and grab them with their foot if the adult doesn't feed them.
Oh. Well, they know somebody's supposed to be feeding them, I guess. That's what they think. Well, it's interesting. You see fledglings even of small birds, just like, the food's right there, dude. You can just pick it up and eat it yourself. But no, they have to be fed by the... I've seen crows doing that at the beach. Dead salmon on the beach that the crows, that the adults are all picking at. And here's this juvenile just following along, saying, feed me, feed me. I was like, come on, really?
Yeah, and it's the weirdest thing, because it doesn't matter the species. Like, we've gotten in, like, some young robins and juncos and crows and ravens, and all of them are, if they're young enough, you can, like, pile food so high that they just have to lean over and eat it, and they don't. They just scream at you.
They just want you to drop it in their mouth?
Yep, you got to put it right in there.
That's funny. It's funny to imagine the human equivalent of that and just be like, yeah, my kids, no. Feed yourself. But I guess, obviously, they learn. Because within, like, with songbirds that are doing multiple clutches in the summer, by a week or two later, they're kind of doing their own thing, and you'll see them not chasing around so much. But that first little out of the nest time. Well, and it makes them easier to see too, because they're just making all sorts of noise. Of course, that makes them easier to catch as well for the sharp-shinned hawks and the merlins and such. You got to figure it out quick, or you just get eaten.
Oh yeah, that's absolutely.
Kind of how that works, I guess. So do you get a lot of, you get some smaller birds? I guess numbers wise, you could get a bunch of them, and still it wouldn't be as much feeding and work as an eagle was because of the size, but.
The smaller birds can be more work.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. Cause we had a robin in this year that came in like just out of the egg. Like you could see it still had the yolk that it was absorbing. And luckily we have an incubator for that. But those birds, when they're that little, you know, you feed them a very small amount because their stomachs are so small. But it's pretty much every half hour.
That's true,
if it's a hummingbird, it's every 15 minutes from sunup to sundown.
You've got hummingbirds?
We haven't ever had to raise baby hummingbirds, thankfully. At least here. But one of the centers I worked at down in Wisconsin, we got little tiny hummingbird bird eggs, and the director was like, we may as well try, and then they hatched, and we were like, wait, no.
That's a bunch of them. Yeah. And what are they, obviously we think of hummingbirds as going to our hummingbird feeders, which is basically sugar water, but I know that they also need protein, and so for the young birds, actually with songbirds as well, it's, you know, seed eaters, ordinarily, often, mostly seed eaters will be gathering insects for the young, so I suppose... that's probably true for hummingbirds as well. So what are you feeding them?
So luckily there's a couple of different like powder mixes that have been created to help with that. So there's just the nestling powder mix. We mix it with water till it gets kind of like yogurt. Fill up a syringe, shove it in the bird's mouth.
Just drop it in.
For the hummingbirds, there's a different one that, as you said, has that protein. We also put out a little cup to catch fruit flies and would feed them fruit flies.
Okay.
But it's really important they get the right diet.
Yeah.
And not here, it hasn't happened here in Sitka, but down south where there are just more birds and people, we would often get people that were like, bring in this little bird, and they're like, I fed it bread. Like, that's not good at all. Just bring us the bird. We'll do it.
Yeah. Well, so that's a good thing to mention. So I know that people sometimes they find young birds, fledglings, just somebody posted on Facebook in the Sitka Birds group the other day, like there was a northern flicker that was kind of, it was up in a tree on a branch, but it was kind of like being weird, and it was probably recently out of the nest and mm-hmm. not really very coordinated, and they were wondering, does it need help? Or, and sometimes you'll find these birds on the ground. There was a juvenile or fledgling junco that was on my roof recently that just was there for hours, and that's not normal behavior, right?
I mean, yeah.
For it is probably for fledgling, but not what we usually see of birds. So it's easy to imagine, well, that bird must be injured, so
right,
I need to
right.
help it. But what is, like, do you have any guidelines or suggestions for people if they're observing birds for having a sense of when it might be a good idea to call for help, essentially, which would, I suppose, involve calling the Raptor Center?
Yeah, so. I mean, we're, especially this summer with less visitors, we're always happy to come out and take a look if people aren't sure about it. Like, mm-hmm. We don't want anyone to ever hesitate thinking they're wasting our time. Like, it's a bird, it's what we do. For the most part, especially now that the first batch of songbirds are getting ready, like, are leaving the nest, people will see a bird that looks fully feathered and looks the size of an adult, but it doesn't fly very well.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no visible injury, like, if their wings look good and everything else looks good, then we always try and ask them to just leave the bird alone. Move it to a more protected space if there's a cat or a dog, mm-hmm. because that can be a big problem. If it looks like it still has, like, some fluffiness on it, then definitely call us. What we'll do then is we'll try and just re-nest the bird.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to do that successfully with two baby crows. We got them back up into their nest. And then there was a Steller's jay that I nailed a Tupperware onto a tree and put some moss in it and put the baby Steller's jay in it. And the parents were screaming at me the whole time.
Oh, wow.
Because sometimes they will fall out of the nest when they're too young.
Yeah.
And our number one goal is if we can re-nest them, we will re-nest them. Like, even if nature can be cruel and they might not survive, it's better that they're with their parents in nature right. than with us. If it's naked, definitely call us.
Right. Yeah, so if it doesn't have its feathers. You know, and it is kind of tough. There's, you know, you mentioned the crows and the jays, and they're both nest robbers.
Yeah.
As are ravens. There's a particular alarm call that thrushes make that's kind of this high-pitched call that I kept hearing, and it's described as the aerial predator alarm.
Oh,
so I was thinking
cool.
of it as like hawks, and I was like, I kept hearing these robins mostly making this call, and I was like, I'd be looking around for hawks, and I finally made the connection one day. There was a robin with food in its mouth making this call, and it was looking at, and I saw there was a raven up in the tree. I was like, oh, that's what's going on. The ravens, especially when they have a nest, because they're not worried about it as an adult, but when they have a nest, a raven in the neighborhood. And then we had a robin nesting in the tree that was kind of at eye level from the second floor. We could see it out the window. And I happened to be there one day when the raven found it. I didn't see initially how the raven found it, but the raven was there, and it was just like in moments. All the babies were gone. Mm-hmm. It just like ate them all, and it was so sad. The adults were the male was bring they. There's really nothing they could do, because if they get too close, they can get killed
yeah.
just as easily.
Yeah.
And I've heard of people seeing ravens kill varied thrushes in the winter, for example. But so there's nothing they can do except be upset. And the male was still carrying food, and I think he must have injured his foot, kind of. Maybe trying to fly at the raven, but to no avail. Mm. And it was like an hour that it was just sitting there calling and carrying this food around my yard. I was like, oh, how sad.
Yeah.
But then then they kind of left and they didn't come back. And that raven, though, I saw like systematically work all the branches in the trees right around there, just looking for more nests. So, it is kind of tough out there for them. But the re-nesting them, the jays, so was this was in town, like near town, there was a nest? Or
it was out HPR,
yeah.
up one of the like really steep roads.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Little section of woods by someone's house.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I know they're around in the summer, I don't see them as often, and I don't know where they nest. I've assumed kind of in the forest somewhere, but of course there's so many houses that are just right against the forest.
Yeah, yeah.
So. It's interesting that, I mean, they were clearly aware that that was their young one, and they wanted to take care of it.
But yep.
Yeah, having it, because cats are a big, and dogs, I'm sure, but probably cats more.
Yeah, we tend to get more cat attacks than dog attacks. Mm-hmm. Like, dogs, if they find a bird, they might play with it to death.
Yeah. Yeah, they're just curious about it.
Yeah, they're just, really what's predatory, that? I'm going to put it in my mouth. But cats, unfortunately, they have a lot of bacteria on their claws and their teeth. So when we get a bird in that's we know is a cat attack, we have to give it antibiotics right away. Because even if it's not very injured, if it's got one little like nick from a claw, it can get a really bad bacterial infection and die from that.
Yeah, the cats are. Yeah, I mean that's what they're wired to do. Is
oh yeah, I mean I don't.
Well, no, I don't
blame the cats.
Right. Well, when there's outdoor cats, it's like that's gonna happen.
Yeah. And even the thing is, even cats with wonderful loving homes.
Yeah.
If they go outside, they're predators. It's what they're bred, not bred, but it's what they do.
Right. Yeah. It's their instinct.
Yeah. In fact, my roommate has outdoor cats, and we had to come to a compromise because I got tired of finding dead birds in my room.
Right. So that's where they ended up.
Yeah. They brought them to me.
Yeah.
It's a present. But we bought these lovely little collars that are like bird safe collars. They're very colorful and vibrant, and that way the cat can't sneak up on the birds. And
does that help?
I haven't gotten any more birds in my room.
Okay. Well, I mean, cause I had seen those, there was somebody that had a cat that was actually caught a rail twice.
Oh my gosh.
A Virginia rail here. And the rail was fine both times.
That's impressive.
Cause rails are really unusual here. So the only rails that everyone had seen here were both caught by that cat. Oh, that's not true. There was another rail senior, but more recently, and then the rail stayed the rest of the winter, at least the one winter at the upper end of Swan Lake. But it was I had seen that somewhere. I saw about that collar and that those collars were good. And I guess part of it is just like the bright colors stand out to the birds.
Yeah.
So they're able to
Because the bell collars, the downside is that cats are smart and they can figure out how to gently stalk without the bell, without the bell ringing.
So yeah, it's kind of like a clown collar.
It is.
Vibrantly colored clown
collar.
It
looks ridiculous. It's also got a nice little reflector too, though. Because my worry is always if they're out at night,
right,
you know, they could get hit by a car.
Yeah, that is kind of tough too, because they're like, I've had cats that they're just shadows essentially running in front of you.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're at the side of the road.
So it's kind of nice. It protects the birds, protects the cat.
Yeah.
Makes them look ridiculous.
Yeah. That's all fun then.
Yeah.
So if folks are seeing birds, a lot of times the fledglings are just figuring things out. So, you know, putting them, so that's one thing when birds often hit windows. That's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they're just dead.
Mm-hmm.
But other times they're just kind of stunned. And so usually if I found them, I've usually, because again, cats in the neighborhood, I try to put them up on an elevated part that's kind of comfortable. And then I usually would check on them later and they're typically gone. So it's like they just kind of got stunned.
Yeah, they get kind of stunned for a bit.
Yeah. That's the sort of thing. But if in doubt, you guys are happy at the Raptor Center to...
Oh, yeah. We'll come and take it. If someone finds a fledgling and they're not sure, you know, call us. Or if they find a fledgling and if they got a cat and they know their cat's going to go after it, we can, you know, we would rather the fledgling was able to stay in the wild.
Right.
But if there are human-caused dangers in the wild that the fledgling can't avoid, we'll try and intercede. Speaking of moving them, if people see the nest, there's the old myth that if you touch a bird, the parents won't accept it.
Mm.
That is not true at all. Of most animals, in fact. Mm-hmm. Like, if you touch a baby rabbit, the mom is just going to be like, I smell weird.
Yeah.
But they're not going to kick their offspring out just because of that.
Okay.
Most birds don't have a great sense of smell.
Right.
So, I mean, don't pick up the baby and play with it and mess with it because that'll scare it. But
right. Well, that's sometimes I wondered about. So, like, I've cat killed birds. I had a neighbor that liked to get cats, and the bird was dead. But I mean, actually, I've had birds die in my hand, and that we got from the cat. But I didn't see any obvious injuries, and so I was like, are they just dying from shock, or I guess it could have like broke its neck or something. But I don't know. Can the birds, are they high strung enough that essentially like in that sort of a scenario they'll just die of shock? Or
yeah, especially the smaller birds like warblers and siskins and stuff. If they get too, so like if a cat's playing with the bird, which you know they like to play with their meal. Even if it's just like 5 minutes, that's 5 minutes of the bird in the most utter terror it's ever been in. It can't escape. Its adrenaline is going nuts. So sometimes we do get birds in that even if, like, as you said, they don't have injuries, they've just been through such a stressful information that their body just kind of is like, nah, I'm done. We're done. This is enough.
Yeah. Well, I do remember there was a couple of folks that were doing studies on owls, and I got to watch them band a screech owl.
Oh.
And they mentioned that when you laid the owl back on its side, it just, like, it went calm. And they're, you know, they might be a little feisty, but once you did that. Actually, the same thing with hummingbirds. A guy, a hummingbird bander, was in town, and he said, yeah, once you, they can be a little feisty, but you lay them on their back, and it's, I guess it's just like, if that happens in the wild, they're done. So there's no point in finding, it's just like, relax and let nature take its course, I guess, at some level. But then, of course, they're fine once they got set up again, and they were very gentle doing the banding and that kind of thing that they needed, but certainly made it easier that they weren't, like, clawing and scratching and biting.
Yeah, yeah. We also, we'll cover a bird's eyes with, like, a towel or even a hood for some of our bigger birds, and that helps calm them a lot.
Yeah. That's interesting, the different ways that, because, you know, you're just trying to help them, but it's not like you can communicate that to them very easily.
Oh, no. So. And we sometimes, with newer volunteers, we have to, like, gently remind them that, like, this isn't a dog. Telling the bird it's going to be okay is, in fact, not okay.
not helpful,
because, you know, instinctively you want to be like, oh, it's all right, it's okay, calm down. But the best thing for them is silence and efficiency. So we just work as fast as we can, put them back in their kennel where they're safe.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. And do you have, do you notice big differences in species or individuals? Like, are the differences between individuals within a species bigger than the differences between species? Or do you, like, in terms of how they respond, how they react, like whether they're, I guess, quote unquote, friendly or not, or just really, really grumpy.
None of them are friendly.
Yeah.
Zero friendly. The more predator oriented birds, and then with that, the bigger they are, the more they tend to be willing to fight back.
Yeah.
Which is actually a good thing. It's good to see birds that are trying to fight us, because it means they feel healthy enough to try and take on a human, at least enough to escape, which is great.
Yeah.
And the thrushes can be surprisingly confident, which is really neat.
Berry thrushes or the brown
berry thrushes and robins we've had this year. And there's sometimes when you go in to give them food, they'll beat clack at you, which is like a warning to back off.
It's funny how intimidating even small animals can be sometimes, like, whoa.
Yeah, And then hummingbirds, too, are ones that are surprisingly, like, well, they fight, they scream, they yell at you, they're so mad about everything.
Yeah, the rufous hummingbirds, they're just, especially, seem like they're bullies. And they're, I mean, they'll fly right up into your face sometimes to check you out, you know, when they're fine. But, yeah, the hummingbird bander, he had a way with them that just, like, he did, they chirped at him sometimes. There definitely was, like, I'm sure it was the string of expletives that, you know, in hummingbird language. They were definitely riled up, but yeah, he would get them banded and then set them on his hand and they just bounce off and go. Sometimes they didn't realize that they were free to go for a moment, so it was, it'd take them a moment, but then they'd take off. And, yeah, I suppose that sort of feistiness, is a sign of liveliness, which is what you want to see from birds you're going to let go again.
Yeah, yeah. If we get an eagle in and we can just pick it out of the crate and it doesn't wiggle or struggle or anything, that's typically not a great sign.
No.
They can recover from it, but that's one of the, it's a behavior that we make a very strong note of. If any of the birds don't try and escape us, and we're like, all right, you're sick enough that something is getting in the way of your natural instinct to escape a human.
Would severe dehydration do that, or would?
Yeah, yeah. Severe dehydration can do it. Head injuries, being in a lot of pain, pretty much just not being totally healthy.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I guess I think about when I get sick or really dehydrated or something, and just kind of that really that feeling of lethargy. That's just like, do I really want to do anything?
Yeah, yeah. And then if someone came up and grabbed you, would you just be like, fine,
whatever.
Yeah, but if you're healthy, you'd probably, you know,
right. Yeah,
punch or something.
That makes sense. Yeah, it is. It's interesting. I suppose. Do you? I guess, you know, you get what comes in, so you have opportunities to kind of get to know birds, maybe different species at different times, just depending on what happens to have been found and brought in during the year. And so, is that something kind of like that you look forward to? It's just like, I mean, obviously it's better if they can be raised out in the wild, but when you have a chance to do some rehab and stuff, and is it interesting to kind of observe the differences, and like you mentioned that the thrushes were assertive,
yeah,
and confident in their approach to you, but just kind of getting a sense a little closer, because not a lot of people like to watch birds, but they don't all get a chance to. I mean, it's an opportunity and a challenge because it's like a lot of work.
Yeah,
raise these birds in the case of young birds that come out of the nest, but to rehab the birds.
Yeah, and yeah, just to help them. I mean, yeah, it is a lot of work, and it's a strange situation where with every bird we try to treat it as though it's releasable. Mm-hmm. So we invest as much time and care as we can, and then it dies.
Right.
But we do our best to still keep that level of compassion for the mm-hmm. animals, just so they receive the best quality care. So you invest a lot in them, and
right.
so you really get into, you know, seeing how they behave.
Sometimes when you put that effort in
and
kind of get attached a little bit. And
yeah, it's sad, and it's a lot of times frustrating, especially when it's a bird that was injured because humans are doing our thing.
Right.
And it's also kind of hard when, like, young kids bring in a bird that's injured, but we don't really sugarcoat it. We give them the truth, and, you know, honestly, at the end of the day, if all we can provide that bird is a safe, warm place to die, then it's better than terrified in the wild, I guess.
Yeah.
But it is neat to see them up close and see their behaviors and kind of just learn weird little things that I wouldn't have expected.
Right.
We have a robin right now that just goes nuts for salmon berries.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Which, like, I thought they would have wanted the earthworms that we meticulously dug up, but nope.
Yeah, the berries. It is funny. Like cedar waxwings, for example, they show up late, and they show up late because they don't. I think, unlike most birds, they actually will feed their young birds berries. And so
they're primarily berry eaters.
Yeah, if they're not, the insects aren't really so appealing, but they need to be here late enough that we actually have ripe fruit. Mm-hmm. Which for here, this year is a little later, but the salmon berries are going pretty good. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I see thrushes eating the huckleberries, you know, when they get ripe. And I don't see them eating the blueberries as much, but I've seen raven cough pellets like full of blueberries, so the ravens are clearly at least eating them. I imagine the thrushes are too. I just happened to notice that. But it's kind of interesting. It seems like fascinating and challenging work. But yeah, feeding every half hour or every 15 minutes from sunrise to sunset's a long time.
Yeah, especially in
this
summer.
Time of year.
Yeah.
So you have somebody that basically just has to. I guess you have shifts probably, but like from early in the morning to late at night.
Yeah, we will we'll divvy it up so someone takes the baby home with them.
Oh, okay.
Because we couldn't leave it. We leave work at 4 and we don't get in until 8, and that's too long.
Right.
And then during the day, our office staff is amazing and will actually help us out with that a lot.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So when we get the really young babies in, we just put the incubator on Lolly's desk and show her how to do it. Because you do with the really young ones, when we feed them that songbird formula, it's in a syringe, and you have to basically shove it down the bird's throat and just make sure you're not getting it down their airway at all. Mm. It's easier in birds than mammals, because in birds, the opening to their airway is like at the base of their tongue as opposed to in their actual throat.
Okay.
So it's a little nicer than trying to tube feed a bunny, but.
Yeah. Well, I've seen young birds in the nest, like very awkward looking, but giant yellow bills, you know.
Yeah.
and just even like my movement would trigger them to open up.
Yeah.
So they're ready to eat. So if people find nests, you know, often I've heard people saying, "Oh, I found a nest and there's no adult around," but it's best to just kind of back off from that. And like it could be that something happened to the adult, but a lot of times it seems like they're just, like, if you're around, they're trying to.
Yeah, for a lot of the songbird species, I mentioned the jays going after me, but corvids tend to be a little more willing to scream at humans.
Right, yeah, they're aggressive, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the songbirds will leave, because at the end of the day, I mean, it's better that there's a live parent than live babies, because if there's no live parent, what are they going to do for the babies? And in that case, you know, again, they can always call us if they're not sure. But it is, if there's no feathers on the birds, you can kind of tell if their skin is very wrinkly and their belly is, like, not distended. Then they're probably dehydrated and haven't had food. So that means their parent hasn't been there in a while. There's also little tricks of like laying little bits of like moss in certain places or putting string over the nest. And that way you can see if the string's been disturbed, that means the parent is coming back.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause they will leave.
Yeah. 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 I've watched them, you know, step back. I discovered a nest on accident, usually because either there's begging young or the adult flew out and startled me.
Yeah.
Because I was walking by, you know, someplace on a trail, especially ground nesters. Mm-hmm. And so then I would watch, and then I was able to see the bird like carrying food and knowing that I knew and mm-hmm. not, but I don't know that it knew I knew where the nest was, but knowing that I was aware of it and sort of trying to, and then going in and feeding them. But yeah, and some birds are definitely, they don't really care that much. They just go in and they do their thing. Chickadees are like, we're back in this hole here. You know, we're not worried about you. And they just fly right in.
Oh, yeah. Chickadees are great.
Yeah, there was a chickadee nest. I'm sure they fledged by now. But right on the trail at the entrance to the park is a snag. And there's a hole. And they were just going in and out. We were standing, you know, 2 feet from the snag. And it was like I could reach the hole. It wasn't that high even. But yeah. They didn't care.
They're another bird that, like, I would always assume that the smaller the bird, the more their life is full of stress and terror. So, like, they're going to run as fast as they can, as soon as they can. But chickadees, they're one of my favorite birds because they just, you know, they'll mob larger birds. They're able to survive cold winters, even though they're tiny. And
they've got a lot of spunk. Yeah, they do seem like they can be a little bit aggressive as well. So.
Yeah.
Well, so what's the best way for folks you know, I know to I guess be aware of. I know y'all have a website, but and it sounds like things are starting to open up a little bit now in terms of people being able to visit and see what's going on there at the Raptor Center. I guess it's probably less busy this summer because we don't have the cruise ships.
Much
and
less
so
busy,
forth.
Yeah. And we're only open Thursday through Saturday.
Okay.
By appointment only, just to make sure we don't get huge mobs of people.
Yeah. So if folks were interested in seeing what you've got going on and learning a little bit more about bird rehab, then.
Oh, absolutely. Then, they're welcome to come visit. We've got quite a few education raptors on display, so they can see them and learn about them a bit, and our flight training center, and then staff that are willing to answer whatever questions.
Oh, nice. Well, yeah, anything else you'd like to mention here before we finish up?
If you can't keep your cat inside, please buy one of those collars, because I want the island to be full of collared cats.
All right. Well, I will, I'll try and refind it, but if you can send it to me, I'll put a link on my,
oh, absolutely.
My webpage when I post the recording of this show, because yeah, it is a little frustrating as a bird watcher primarily to be like, come on, cat. they're out there in the yard, and you see them. And so if I see them in my yard, they're you know neighborhood cats, I guess. Some birds, it's interesting. Some cats don't seem to care at all. Like they really are, but you don't really know until you actually watch the cat a lot.
Yeah. Our two cats, one, the minute if she gets out without her collar, there's going to be a dead bird. The other one just loves bugs.
Yeah.
Just chases moths all day. Like, there could be a bird sitting on her head, and she would just go after a moth instead.
Yeah. It's funny how that works. But, but yeah, so if I see a cat out there, I just kind of startle
shoot
it off
away,
and
shoot
it away. But, yeah, there's, I mean, it's rough life for a bird.
It's hard.
A lot of predators. So. Thanks for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Thanks. It was fun.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded this past week with Hannah Blanke. She works with the Alaska Raptor Center here in Sitka, and I want to thank her for taking some time out of her week to visit with me. And also thank you for listening here on the Sitka Nature Show. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. Or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.